This is Paul Morledge of the UW Oral History Project. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 1998, at 8:30 a.m., and we are in the office of Professor Donald Novotny, and we're going to begin today's session by talking about his rise to associate professor in 1965 here at the UW.
Well, I actually was promoted in 1964 to associate professor. After 3 years in the grade of assistant professor, there were a number of things contributed to the promotion that I actually mentioned some of on the previous tape. One was the Kiko for Teaching Award, and the other one was the forthcoming publication of a textbook. The book actually was published in 1965. It was authored by my major professor and colleague Norbert Schmitz and myself. Title was Introductory Electromechanics. It was the book, or it was the material that we used in the required course on electrical machines at that time. Actually, the book turned out not to be terribly widely used as a textbook around the country, but there were parts of the book that were somewhat original that were very widely adopted by people in their research and are still used. The book is now 30 some years old, and it's still referenced for certain topics on what are called winding functions. It was actually translated into Russian as well, and they kept all the errors. They didn't correct any of them. Maybe a few comments about the electric machines research in those early days. This is the period of, 1961 or so, all the way through the 70s. My work was principally on what I would have to call electric machine theory. In those days, in the beginning of that time period, computers were in their infancy. And to make the electric machine is described by a set of nonlinear differential equations, which makes them not easily solved. So the only way to handle transient or dynamic problems was to do a computer solution of the differential equations. And in fact, to put things into perspective, when I was an undergraduate, the university where the IIT got its first computers to be used by students. So I was programming on some of the very early IBM machines. Some of the early research was directed at effective ways of solving the differential equations of the electric machine on the computers of those days. Actually, the most effective way in the early days was to use an analog computer, which really was strictly that. It was an analog. It was a set of electric circuits that had the same differential equations, and you just let those circuits run and see what they did. You had to be a technician to do that, a pretty good technician to run an analog computer. Some of the early work by colleagues of mine, Joe Wirtz and Fred Fath, we published some papers in those days that had been widely referenced on techniques for doing fast solutions of differential equations. Another area that was just getting started at the same time as computers were becoming available was power electronics. That simply means transistor-like solid-state switches that could switch large amounts of power. And these switches were starting to be applied to the control of motors. And in fact, one of the very earliest papers that I published with a master's student was an analysis to show that what had been observed in a laboratory when a certain kind of switching was done, the fact that when the terminal voltage to a single phase motor was suddenly reversed, suddenly flipped, and this had to be done very fast electronically, that sometimes the motor would reverse. And that made no sense from a static or steady state point of view. And we set out to see whether we could predict it on the computer, and we could, it turned out. And we actually made some high-speed photography to show that our solution, not only was our solution predicting reversal, but the actual rate at which the machine reversed was also predicted correctly. That paper, incidentally, when we published it, we received a couple of unsolicited letters from people in the field who were really impressed that you could show that kind of thing on a machine.
Can I ask, what does that mean exactly? What's the significance of that?
Actually,
reverses too.
Well, you would not expect, if you just pulled the plug out on a single phase motor and turned the plug over and plug it back real quickly, that the motor would run the other direction. It doesn't do
that.
It does not do that. Yeah. If you pull it out and reverse it slowly and put it back, it doesn't do that. But sometimes on smaller motors, if you did it very fast, but you had to do it electronically to do it fast enough, it would actually reverse. And there was no basis in theory for that to happen, based on steady state theory. At one time, one of the washing machine manufacturers contacted me and said they were interested in thinking about whether they could use that to produce the agitation in a washing machine. Okay, but it turned out not to be a workable idea. So what was happening right at that time was a very early beginnings of power electronics, and machines were being subjected to modes of operation that they had never been subjected to before. So this work on simulating machines and getting the computer to work was very important. And that's where I spent probably 10 or 12 years in that kind of activity in the early 60s up until the early 70s. In 1966, I had the opportunity to be a visiting professor at Montana State University. It was a wonderful experience. I spent 3 months there. They wanted me to come and teach a course, which I did, on modern machine theory. And I spent all the free time I had trying to learn how to catch trout on a dry fly in the Gallatin River.
Is that in Bozeman?
Bozeman, yeah, that was in Bozeman, Montana. In 1967, or thereabouts, our new chairman, Jim Skiles, approached me and asked whether I would be willing to be an associate chairman to handle the undergraduate program. But I had never had any thoughts about being involved in department administration. But I thought, maybe it'd be interesting, maybe it would be fun. So I accepted with some reservations because I had virtually no experience and because I would be trying to administer things to colleagues to my major professor, for example, who was still on the faculty, and I would be, might be doing things which would involve him in some significant way. But I found after I got involved, that it was indeed a lot of fun. It was something different. I was very interested in undergraduate education. I actually initiated a significant revision of the curriculum, updating of the curriculum, plus all the other things that go with the undergraduate activity. I was, for example, the person to whom students with real academic problems had to come in if they needed a special signature. Whatever, sort of like the departmental dean of undergraduate affairs, and I enjoyed it, and I did it for I think the whole 4 years that Jim Skiles was chairman. I graduated my first PhD finally in 1968. John Granger was also my first master's student. And then they came along pretty rapidly from that point on. In 1968, I was promoted to professor. Actually, the promotion to professor is not nearly as significant a thing in your life as the promotion to associate professor, because the associate professor one is the tenure one, the tenure decision.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the promotion to professor, well, you certainly want to be promoted. You've already sort of been you've been sort of certified by the faculty in some sense or other, and presuming that you don't go totally to sleep, maybe you'll be promoted to professor at a reasonable time later. I was promoted in 4 years, which is fairly fast. In during this period in 19, I think 71, I think I was I agreed to run for the divisional committee, the physical sciences divisional committee. That is, of course, in my opinion, the probably the most important all university or most important university level committee that there is, because that is that's the committee that makes decisions, makes recommendations on whether or not people should be promoted, and whether or not courses should be approved or dropped. And you know, a university is seems to me, if you have control over the courses and control over the faculty, what else is there?
Just within a physical science.
Yes, there's correct. There's four divisions. Yeah. There's four divisions. Right. And the committee met, it's a committee of about 12 people, and we always met at that time on Saturdays, I think one Saturday a month, unless we had too much work to do. That was a little annoying, because I rather liked my Saturdays, but mostly it was in the springtime that this happened. I actually became chairman of the committee in my last term. I think you're on for 3 years, and I became chairman in my third year and chaired the committee. And as I always remembered as a sidelight, that I was chairman of the division when we approved Chancellor Ward's tenure. And he was, when he was an assistant professor in geography, I think. I forget. Anyway, there was no case. It was a very strong case.
Yeah. It's the present chancellor, Chancellor Ward.
Yeah. Yes. I say every Saturday meeting was a very painful business, but it's only for a short period of time. One thing I do remember, at that time, we were wrestling with whether or not student evaluations, teaching evaluations, should be required as part of the tenure package that's presented on for faculty. And it was very interesting, because I'm always been very interested in undergraduate teaching. And I always use teaching evaluations because I wanted the feedback. But my feeling was that since we didn't require anything else in particular, we just said you should show us competency and excellence in teaching. And if that involved teaching student evaluations, it was fine. If that involved writing textbooks or getting letters from colleagues or whatever, I thought you should be able to do whatever you want. There was a chap on the committee, I don't remember his name, and he felt as strongly as I did the other way. And we had some long debates about it. And actually, I lost. It is required. I still think that it's, well, maybe you can argue they're different. One of my arguments was, look, we don't require that you send in your manuscripts that have been rejected as evidence of your activity. We only look for the good ones, so why should you have to turn in all your teaching evaluations? This is a poor argument. It's a poor argument. Anyway, it's probably a good idea that we require them, but I guess what I was objecting to at the time was that our list, our document that you had to follow to submit somebody for tenure was getting longer and longer and longer and more detailed, and I was thinking that we really had to be more open about what people sent in and just demonstrate a good case, whichever way, whatever kind of evidence you have. From that point, we had a new chairman, and lo and behold, he asked me if I was willing to continue as an associate chair. And I don't think I was too keen about it at that point. It was 4 years already, but he said, "Well, you can do the graduate program. You haven't done that." So
who was the chair at this time?
This was Vince Rideout, okay. I believe, and I think it was Rideout. And then. So anyway, I ended up as associate chairman in terms of the graduate program. I enjoyed the undergraduate one more. The graduate program was less work, because there are less graduate students, and there's not a curriculum. There's only certain minimal requirements. But I did it. I'm not sure. I don't remember whether I did it for 2 years or 4 years. In fact, I think it must have been 2 years because in 1974, I had the opportunity to go on leave. And so I couldn't have been associate chair for 74 and 75. So it probably was 2 years, probably 72. Anyway, I had an invitation to go to the Netherlands, to the Eindhoven Technological University in Eindhoven, Netherlands. They had some funding, and it was possible to get half of your money from the research committee, a wonderful, wonderful thing, by the way. The research committee, using money that came from WRF, provided funding to people to be on leave since there's no sabbatical program. You had to get half your money from the wherever you were going. But I succeeded in doing so, an immensely significant trip, professionally, as well as an enormously wonderful, just as a personal experience. Family went along, my wife went along, my younger daughter went along, who was 14, and I've always said that she kind of grew up there in that year because she learned Dutch and went to a Dutch high school and just became a young lady. Dated a little Dutch boy, off on their bicycle together. The main thing, the reason it was important for me is I came upon something which completely altered what I did for the next 20 years. And that was, I discovered something that the Europeans called complex vector analysis of machines. And I was absolutely astounded. It combined these differential equations that I had been trying to solve for many years into a different form, which made use of the symmetry they had and was enormously useful in terms of not only making calculations, but also visualizing what was happening. And I found that, amazingly enough, I discovered that it wasn't something that they developed at all. It was developed in the United States in the 50s. And we never did it. There was a book written by a fellow by the name of Lyon, and the book just went into obscurity, except that the Japanese, the Russians, the Europeans all grabbed hold of this idea and carried it, and we didn't. We struggled along doing what I had been doing. And in matter of fact, I reflected a lot about why, because there was an enormous amount to be gained based on what they were doing with complex vectors. And I'm convinced that the reason is that we led the world in computer power, in computers and computer power, so we could solve these miserable equations. And they didn't have computers, very good ones, and if any at all in some cases, and they couldn't. So they had to be a lot more clever in how they were going to go about things. And they developed and carried forward this complex vector theory. Well, actually, ultimately, this led to, well, what it convinced me was that I should become a kind of, a salesman and sell the U.S. Industry and so on, that this is the way to do things and the way to think about machines. So I decided that's one of the things I would try to do. And I decided probably the best way was to do some things with it that you couldn't do very well without it. And I wrote a couple of papers based on the work that I did in there in Eindhoven. And some people started to get interested. But, you know, it takes a long time to break the inertia of an established analytical technique or anything else. It's actually taken, let's see, that was 74. I would say it was about 94, 20 years before it became fairly widely used in the United States.
As far as you know, are you one of the first people to publish a paper using complex vector analysis in the U.S.?
In the U.S., yeah. The U.S.? Well, except for Lyon, who wrote the book in the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. But now, almost all papers are that way. And there are, and I didn't invent anything. It was there.
Right,
yeah, it was there. What I did was I transported it, and I tried to solve some problems, some modern problems, using that, and it turns out you can. You can solve some problems that I had been solving on the computer that were very difficult, took a lot of computing time, and I could solve them in analytic form and get solutions. So also, another reason it was significant is I met a professor there by the name of De Jong, who was a designer, induction motor designer, for many, many years for a Dutch company. But unlike most designers who are quite willing to just know how to get a design that works for their boss, he always worried about why that worked and why the other thing didn't work. So he thought a great deal about machines, and one of the things he taught me about machines was that there's a very large difference between big ones and little ones. Now that may sound silly, but they're obviously different, but what I mean is the way in which a big motor performs in terms of dynamic response, etc., is very, very, very different than little machines. And he talks a lot about what are called scaling laws, and I've also become a proponent of scaling laws in the U.S. because I have on several occasions found that companies have gotten into very serious troubles by carrying out some developmental project on a small motor, a 10 horsepower motor, and then tried to use it on a 500 horsepower motor and had a terrible time. I mean, it just didn't work, just plain doesn't work. Because they are different, you know, they have the same mathematics, but the numbers are so different that the solutions are totally, they look totally different when you do the solutions. And actually, De Jong has remained a friend ever since. In fact, he was responsible for my going back to Europe some years later to be a visitor again. At any rate, when I returned from, a year after I returned from the Netherlands, I was asked if I would be willing to serve as department chair or run as department chair, and I agreed that I would, having had this taste of administration. I thought it would be interesting to try, and so I served. I was elected, we have to elect chairman here in Wisconsin, elected and served from 76 to 1980 as department chairman. And actually, probably if I had to say the one main thing that I wanted to try to accomplish as chairman was to, I don't know, pull the department back together in some sense. Somehow we had broken into two camps, one of which had a very strong research orientation and one of which had a strong teaching orientation, and the two groups were just fighting tooth and nail. And I always felt that, you know, these two were in many ways, they're not really separate. They're very close together. A lot of the research results I've published, I have been able to use in my classroom a year later. But these things had happened, and there was I can't say it was a fragmentation. There is a fragmentation in the department, but it came later. At that time, there were just two fragments, pretty much. And I hoped that I could bring it back together by, a lot of people felt, for example, that there was some unfairness in the loading that the people had. They felt that if they had a big, strong research program, that they were being loaded too much with teaching. And some of the teaching people felt that they were getting too much teaching, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was what I was going to try to do. And I think, to the extent it was possible, maybe I succeeded. At least we got to talking to one another again. It was a long battle. There were all kinds of difficulties. I learned some very interesting things as chairman. I learned, for example, that it's about 10% of the people that report to you, in some sense, about 10% of them cause 90% of the trouble, or cause 90% of the work. And I found that a lot of the problems I had to deal with had nothing to do with electrical engineering or technology or even the university. They were just plain personal problems that people couldn't get along with one another. They just rubbed each other wrong. And all kinds of trivial things like that. I did succeed in hiring some pretty good people. You spend an awful lot of time as a chairman hiring people. I did hire Baha Sala and Bob Lasseter and some others. Those are two in particular I remember because Baha Sala became one of our department chairs and a very well-known person. Spent a lot of time on that. I just have to tell the story of my first time I chaired a faculty meeting. One of the subjects was what should be the test score in a foreign language for admission by foreign students into the EE department. Should it be, it was a TOEFL or something, should it be 500 or 550 or 600 or what? And we were having a long, drawn-out debate about what this should be, and finally I said, well, let's have a vote. I said, we'll take a vote, see what people feel. And I wrote up on the board something about foreign students, and then everybody started to laugh in the room, and it turns out I misspelled foreign, so they thought maybe I should take the exam. and start the whole discussion over again. And of course, in your first meeting, you're fairly nervous anyway. Most of the faculty had been here much longer than I had, and I felt somewhat overpowered, so that it was a little scary. You get used to it.
Yeah,
you get used to it after a while, and you find it's a real education. Probably everybody should do it. I was amazed at how fast some faculty members came in to see me to, so to speak, test the waters, see how hard they could push me.
Really?
Yeah, in the first few days of chair, and how difficult some people sort of made it for you just because of their personality, how some groups simply could not agree on who was going to teach what course so that the chairman would have to do it. I always wanted them to reach an agreement, and most of them did. Hmm. Most of them did.
Can I ask one thing?
Yes.
So each professor didn't have equivalent teaching loads.
That's
it
correct.
It varied?
It varied depending upon what else they were doing.
Okay, but it sounded like to me you wanted to make it pretty much even.
No, at that time we had a document, it was called the ACRE report. Forget what ACRE stood for, ACRE. And it spelled out and was approved by the college faculty what a typical load for a faculty member was, or what an idealized loading. And it talked about regular classes, it talked about graduate student supervision, and it talked about committees and other activities like that. And the magic number was 12. You were supposed to come up with a loading of 12 hours. A three-credit course, if it was something you had taught before, was three hours. If you had never taught it before, you could give an extra hour. And so on, and you try, and this meant that some people with lots of grad students taught one course, and some people with no grad students taught three, or sometimes four, even as much as four courses. So everybody had a different load if you looked at just their classroom teaching. Yes, that was true.
Okay.
As far as personally was concerned, midway through that period of department chairman was when the oil crisis occurred in the late 70s, and the price of energy went very high. And at the same time during that period, the field of power electronics was growing. I mean, more and more devices were available to do switching of large amounts of power. So we suddenly had the capability to do something. It was expensive because it was new technology and the devices were new. But we had the capability to do things, and we actually had that capability for several years, but all of a sudden the energy crisis changed everything. because it suddenly made a potential market. Because if you could improve the efficiency of a motor drive, you could pay for the cost of the equipment that improved it very, very fast because of the immense increase in the cost of energy. So it just seemed to me at that time that the time was ripe to put together some kind of a support organization with industry to help them get into this business and help them develop this business and help us develop our program. Also, my colleague, Professor Schmitz, was close to retirement, and I felt very strongly that I would like to have another person in that field that I could work with and try to get him here, ideally, before Professor Schmitz retired. So I had two goals, to get some kind of... Okay, so somewhere in the 79-80 time frame, I had this notion that the time was ripe to develop a support organization because of the availability of power electronics and the low cost of energy. And secondly, that I would very much like to bring a faculty member on board before Professor Schmitz retired. But unfortunately, at that time, and probably still, I don't know, the university had what's called position control as well as budget control. And so you had to generate a new position in your department as well as fund it. So my thought was, if I could get 6 or 8 Wisconsin companies to subscribe to an organization by putting up some money, that would be a strong demonstration that they felt this was important for the state of Wisconsin and that I would be able to pry out of the university a faculty position in the department. And I already knew who I wanted because Professor Tom Lippo, who had received his degree here at Madison some years before and had been at General Electric for many years, I knew had gone to Purdue University, and I had been talking to him and found that he was not happy there for a variety of reasons and would be very interested in Wisconsin and was in fact a Wisconsin, that's where he grew up. So that I had a good chance to get him if I could create the job. So got to work creating a proposal for an industrial support organization that I called a consortium because that's what Dean Bollinger called his. John Bollinger had put together something similar in the area of automated welding, as I recall. But his was a little different than I had in mind because his was a 4-year thing and then was going to go away. Mine, I was going to try to set up open-ended that would go on forever. What I did was I wrote a proposal, drafted what I thought might work, gave it to Lippo. He looked it over, gave me some suggestions. And then I went to three companies, to people that I knew that I had met in UIR years before. And went over to Milwaukee. The companies were Eaton Corp. Well, at that time it was Cutler Hammer. Eaton Cutler Hammer was one. Alan Bradley was the second. And the Graham Corporation was the third. And I gave them this proposal. And they gave me back a lot of ideas, which were very good. Excellent ideas. And so they became part of the proposal writing team. Well, then I sort of had them, huh? How could they turn down being part of it if they in fact helped to write it? And as a matter of fact, they did become the first sponsors, and in fact, even more so, Alan Bradley gave us a startup grant of, I believe, $25,000 to get the program off the ground and assist in bringing Professor Lippo here. And so they became the first members of WEMPEC, which is still functioning and currently has something like 60 member companies. The structure, this is an organization that that we created, which involved not just research. It does support research, but it also supports a teaching program helps to expand the teaching program, involves with what we called, the term we used and coined was generic research, meaning that it was research of a widely applicable nature, generally not patentable, and would be useful to all the member companies. Well, you can find some like that, but they're not all that way, obviously. The other thing that we built into it was tried to create a very close interaction between the companies and the faculty and the students. And we did that in a variety of ways, including for the early years, the faculty visited each company once a year. At least one faculty visited, gave a presentation, learned what they were up to, met some of their people, etc. Obviously, with 60 sponsors, we don't do that anymore because we'd never be on campus. It's actually turned around now. The companies come to campus quite regularly. There's usually a company around here every other week. And we've worked very hard to maintain that close interaction. Professor Lippo came in 1980. And the consortium actually started in 81 and has allowed us to expand our graduate student group from maybe six or seven when it first started to now maybe 50 graduate students. There have been something like 140 or so graduates, I believe, out of the program. I think the important characteristics of WEMPEC are, first of all, we kept the fee very low. It's only $7,500. The reason for that is we wanted the engineering manager to be able to do the approval out of his own budget rather than having to go to a vice president. And the reason for that is not that we don't think we could convince the vice president, but I found in the past that the only projects that work with industry are those that are initiated at the level of the engineering groups. The engineers, I guess, don't like to be told by the vice president that you got to work with the university. Okay, that doesn't work. What works is when the engineer thinks that it would be useful to have a collaboration and then gets permission to do it. So we tried to keep the funding approval and the interaction directly at the engineering level. And that has promoted a good, strong interaction at the engineering level. What I'm trying to say is that there was a period of time when we were building up the organization and were adding companies at a high rate that we worked so hard to get to know the companies well that I would guess I spent half of my time on the telephone talking to people at the companies. Now, some of it was very productive. I called them sometimes to ask them questions, or they called to ask me questions. But it was a lot. As a matter of fact, I remember once walking into the graduate student room. And on the big bulletin board there was an elaborate-looking circuit, all kinds of switches and relays and contacts and everything else, and I made the mistake of asking what that was. And they said, that was the latest design of the circuit that was going to let them know when I was on the telephone. Okay, which was strictly a joke, but...
Right, but you knew what they were talking about.
And another time I came back from class, and outside my office was a small table and two chairs with a lamp and a flower vase and a bunch of magazines and a sign saying this is where students could wait in order to get in to see me. Well, they were just poking a little fun of the fact that we were involved with a lot of people in industry at the time. That still happens, but it's reduced somewhat. We also have developed, and this is a very interesting thing, it wasn't something we intended in the beginning, but a very extensive outreach program related to our courses. This gradually grew. We tried videotaping a course, and it became so popular with the engineers at the sponsoring companies that we now have everything on videotape. And we have a full offering of courses and engineers in industry, and not just the ones in the consortium, of course, but they're the biggest clientele because they know about us, can get degrees without ever leaving their place of business. And that has grown. It started out in a very small way when we decided we should occasionally, we would publish, in addition to research reports of the research of our students, that we would also produce what we call tutorial reports, which were whenever we wrote new notes for a class that we used on campus, we would call the tutorial report and send it out to the companies. And they were very popular because they took a lot of, you know, many the what was going on in many, many technical papers and condensed it down into one and gave it a tutorial flavor, so they were very popular. And that is perhaps I think the educational program of WEMPEC is as strong and as in demand as the research program of WEMPEC. That's pleased me very much because I intended it to be that way in the beginning, and it has in fact come out that way. The some of the things that the research program in WEMPEC essentially, I think, is takes advantage of the coming of age of power electronics. That's really where it has been. Just a few comments about WEMPEC research in general, the general nature of WEMPEC research. Power electronics has been combined with motors has been the main thrust, of course. That has led to the situation in many cases where motors do strange things from the perspective of what we've been used to. And WEMPEC has looked at a lot of those. One of the kinds of problems that WEMPEC has looked at a great deal, kind of a general type of problem, is where something strange happens in an industrial development project. They figure out how to fix it so it works, but they don't know why it happened in the first place. And they don't have time to go back and look at it. They just have to assume the fix is going to be okay. Then they would come in and tell us about it and say, is that something you could look at? And that's a great project for a student to figure out what it was that was causing that phenomena.
Yeah.
So these are kinds of modeling problems, if you will, to understand why these unusual behaviors occurred. We get, through the years, we've had many problems that were brought to us by industry of that type, and others, where they simply would like some general analytical work in a certain area. If a company brought something in and it was, in fact, what we would consider generic, so that a significant number of WEMPEC companies would be interested, then we do it with WEMPEC money. If it is not, if it's something that would only be of interest to that one company, then we would try, if they're interested, set up a separate project that they fund and do it that way. So both things happen.
How often did that aspect happen?
The second one?
Yeah, the second.
Oh, quite a bit. There are a large number of separate problems that are being done for individual companies.
Not using WEMPEC.
Not using WEMPEC money. One of the interesting things about WEMPEC, well, let me give an example. Well, I better do that, I'll forget it. One of the interesting things is my colleagues said in the beginning, don't you feel with industry money like this that you're going to be too confined in what you can do? They're going to want to control, you know, what you do, and you won't have any freedom to explore new avenues. And to a certain extent, that was true in the beginning, because in the beginning we felt that, by golly, we better do things that they like and appreciate, or they're not going to stay with us. But once we got past the beginning few years, we suddenly moved into a realm where we had this large pot of money, and in effect, we could do, there were no restrictions. There were no restrictions from the companies, no restrictions. In fact, it was written in such that it was considered by the university to be a gift.
Carte blanche.
Yep. And therefore, we had much more freedom than you could ever expect to get on a government grant to look at almost anything that we could. And in these later years, we've been able to explore, you know, really far out things. If it doesn't work, it doesn't make any difference. And they don't all work because we've got 25 or 30 other projects, some of which are going to work. So all we try to watch for is that, you know, overall there's something there for all our sponsors. So that's been an enormous help.
Can I ask an additional question?
Yes.
What do you say your hit rate is on solving some of those specific problems of companies? The ones that would, I mean, were there a lot of times where you couldn't solve it either? Or was
no,
there...
I think in problems where something happened and they want to know why it happened, those we invariably, the rate is very high. On projects where they're trying to look at the possibility of using something as a product, that may very well, you know, our part of the development may very well be fine, and when they start looking at costs and so on, it's just doesn't work. There, the hit rate is much, much lower, but it's cost is very much cost driven. A good example of an area that we made significant contributions in is the area called what I call current regulators. Electric motors are typically driven from a power supply that where the voltage is constant and the current is whatever it takes to run the motor. But you can also run the motor theoretically from a current supply, and then the voltage is whatever it takes to run the motor. In power electronics, those current regulators are very useful. And so people tried to make current regulators. Well, we've been making them for many years for DC motors, but when we tried to make them for AC motors, all kinds of weird stuff, really strange stuff went on. And it took a surprising length of time, and we did a lot of work here. And one of the papers that we published was by a grad student by the name of Broad, David Broad, and that paper is very widely referenced about current regulators and how they work and why they have problems and so on. The area, the control of motors in the general area referred to as field orientation has been an immense activity in WMPEC. We wrote some of the very earliest tutorials. It was something came out of a German PhD studies and very obscure looking stuff. It took a long time to untangle it and show, and it turns out to be a pretty straightforward thing. So we've done a lot of that. I would say that WMPEC is recognized now as probably the place in the United States for work on electric motor drives and power electronics at higher power levels. There's another organization, a similar one actually, in Virginia that works at lower power levels generally.
What institution is that?
That's at Virginia Polytech. VPI, I guess. And actually, we are currently now in a combined program with them, with some federal funding of what do you call it? Research Center. The Research Center. Soon right after WMPEC was formed, Professor de Jong, that I met in Eindhoven in 1974, had left the company where he was and became a professor, a university professor at the University of Ghent in Ghent, Belgium. And he was after me to come to Ghent for a period. So I did. I actually joined him for 6 months as a Fulbright lecturer. I applied for Fulbright money and spent 6 months there.
What does that entitle you to when you win a Fulbright?
The Fulbright, in my case, was travel money and then all kinds of support from the Fulbright organization.
Like they pay insurance, your housing and food?
No, I just had travel. I was getting the housing and everything from the university.
Oh, I see.
But there was a large amount of support of in terms of people over there. There's an office in Brussels, Belgium, and all kinds of activities involving all the Fulbright people in Belgium, that kind of thing. Turns out that when I was in Netherlands, I made one trip to Ghent because there was a professor at Ghent that had been a professor here in Madison, and he invited me there to give a talk when I was in Netherlands. And I gave a talk, and I had mentioned a couple of problems that were currently, nobody knew what the solutions were. And there was a young student in the audience, and he took me seriously. And when I came to Ghent, by gosh, he'd been working on one of these problems, ever since. And he actually solved it. He actually showed why certain predictions that we had been making for years were qualitatively right. That is, they told you when the motor might have an instability problem, roughly. But they were never quite right. They were always off. You know, if it said it would be unstable at 10 hertz, it wasn't. It became unstable at 8 hertz. And so on. But he found out what it was. And while I was there, he was doing some experiments that were kind of fascinating, and I helped him with those experiments. And we finally wrote a couple of papers on the influence of magnetic saturation on machine dynamics, and kind of cleared up some mysteries that were there. Also, at that time, I pretty much firmed up most of my thinking about complex vector methods, and decided I had to write a book. I was tentatively agreed with Tom Lippo that we would write a book based on our graduate course, and I was busily trying to convince him that it should be a book about complex vectors. Well, I did succeed finally, and we finally did write the book. It took until 1996 to actually get it done, but it is now out there. The return during this period of the early 80s, I was very deeply involved in the research activities of WinPEC. One of the things which I think I mentioned before in the tape is that, that I'd like to say again, when you're in a university, you can change what you're doing without leaving where you are. In the early, I would say in the 60s, I focused pretty much on teaching and writing a book and that sort of stuff. Some research, but my focus was on teaching. And then in the 70s, I got involved in administration. All this time, I still taught and I still had some research. Right. But the biggest part of the job was administration. And now in the 80s, I'm turned back to heavy emphasis on research. Far and away. I still teach. I'm still teaching. I have no administration except WinPEC itself. And I had sort of come full circle. In 84, I was awarded the Benjamin Smith Reynolds Award of the College of Engineering. This is an award for a teaching award in the College of Engineering. It's a very nice accolade to receive because it implies that, you know, that not only your department but the college appreciates what you're doing.
So even though you thought you were concentrating more on research, you ended up winning a teaching award.
Well, I won the teaching award, I think, based upon everything I had been doing.
Oh, just the fact you followed that
path. Kind of the integrated effect, yeah. Because this one, the Benjamin Smith Reynolds Award, is not so much for a new faculty member as it is for a very senior faculty member. Kind of recognition of the whole, of your whole career.
Which is, like you say, research can actually help your teaching.
Oh, very much. Yeah. Very much. And I can actually point at specific papers I've written, technical papers I have written, which appeared in my classes. Now, not so much in the junior class,
right. But
in the senior class and the graduate class. Graduate classes right away, and in senior classes, not very long. And in fact, it's the only way that I was able to keep that senior elective course on electric drives anywhere near up to date, because it was changing so fast as power electronics completely altered the kinds of systems that people are interested in.
And conversely, do you see any times where your teaching helped your research? Like, were you going over the fundamentals, reminding you of some basic research questions?
Oh, yeah. When you try to write, you try to write a tutorial article or a set of notes for your class. As you start to write that, you realize that you think you know what you're doing until you try to put it down so you explain it to somebody else. And then you find you got to go back and look at something over again.
So
they're very closely intertwined. Very closely intertwined. Actually, 1986, I was again invited to come, this time to Belgium, to another university, the University of Leuven. And there I met a young man by the name of Rick de Donker. And Rick was a PhD student. He was finishing up his work. And in fact, what his advisor, one of the things he wanted me to do when I came, because he had just taken on another administrative task, was to kind of finish up with Rick his PhD work. And we made a number of, I just had an enormously eye-opening time as we went through what he was trying to do in terms of some of the ways that I thought about them, and had this enormously fruitful time of mutually teaching each other, and wrote a couple of papers that were quite widely accepted. And I really think at that time I actually wrote a couple of the chapters of the book that finally came out in 1996. I actually wrote them while I was there. So every one of those, now the first trip to Holland was a year, 10 months. The other two were 6 months, 6 months each. And but they were enormously valuable in freshening up my viewpoint, taking off in some new directions, learning some new things. And my advice is, if you go on leave, go to some place like, go to Europe or some place where they don't speak English. That's very important, because the phone rings a lot, and if you answer it and say hello in English, they hang up, and you have no problem. If you're in the U.S., you're going to be bugged all the time, I think. So it's a big help and a very worthwhile thing. Rick de Donker is now a professor, is the professor in this field at the university in Germany, one of the universities in Germany. We tried our darndest to get him here. We have an opening, essentially, to take my place, and we tried very hard to get him here, and I think he would have come for professional reasons. He would have come here, but his wife felt very strongly about getting back home. So I don't know, that's just another one of those things that is so important about those kinds of visits.
Is he currently one of the leading German
engineering institutes? Yes, right now is on the tip of my tongue which one it is. All of this time through the 80s here, I was an associate director of UIR. I did not do very much of what I did when I was young in the UIR program. That is, I didn't go out ringing doorbells and visiting companies, but I acted as the person who handled all queries that came to UIR relative to electrical engineering, and oftentimes other engineering as well. Set up lots of meetings for company personnel on campus, etc. At that time, Bob Marshall, the previous dean of the college before John Bollinger, was actually the head of UIR, and we had become very close. He was the dean when I was chair, and we had become very good friends during the time that I was dean, that he was dean and I was chair. In fact, one of the very interesting things that I learned while I was department chairman was that when people come to see you, when they knock on your door and come in to see the chairman, hardly ever comes with good news. They always got some miserable kind of a problem. And it's kind of depressing, you know, nobody ever comes with a smile on their face. And then one day I was going over to see the dean, and I realized that I never went to see the dean unless I had some kind of a problem. So I thought, well, you know, I'll fix that up. I'll save up a couple of good things, and when I go over there, I'll have a couple of good things first, and then I'll give them the bad news. And then after a few times, he actually said, you know, he says, I always look forward to your visits. You always got something good to say. And then I had to admit to him that I was doing it on purpose. And he said, well, that's okay. Keep doing it. And it worked very well. And we got to be good friends. We used to have lunch together a couple times a week. When Bob died suddenly, because of all the years I had spent, I spent a year in the UIR office as the acting director. Because I was an acting director and viewed it as a one-year thing, and I didn't do anything very drastic, except that I did. They kept trying to suck the people out of the office and put them in other, you know, take some of our personnel and put them somewhere else. And I kept fighting those battles, and I at least held on to the people for the period of time that I was there. That was much more successful than my last act as department chair in this department, when I tried to resist the change of one of the bathrooms in the building that was labeled faculty into one labeled women, and I did not succeed in that battle.
Lois Greenfield had anything to do with
that? Yeah, Lois Greenfield beat me. beat me on that one. But I managed to hold on to UIR. I was followed in the position by Bob Bach, Dean of the Graduate School. Bob Bach ran UIR for the following several years. Somewhere along, I think 1989, roughly, I think that's the date I have here, I was asked to become the chairman of the electrical engineering program for the National Technological University. A couple years before that, the dean here, I think it was the dean, had asked if I would be the, because of my interest in videotape courses, if I would be the representative, EE representative for Wisconsin on NTU. And I went to a few meetings, and I found the concept of NTU to be amazing. I mean, here's an organization of 45 universities who all band together to provide graduate-level coursework via satellite TV, and students can get a degree by taking two courses from Wisconsin and two from Purdue and two from Northwestern and one from Berkeley and so on, and put together a master's program without ever leaving where they're working. And so when they asked if I would be willing to chair the program, I was quite interested, because I decided, you know, if you do this right, I ought to be able to make the best master's program in the world. I got 45 universities to draw on. All I got to do is find where are the strongest courses, where are the best instructors. So that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years.
It's probably quite difficult.
Well, it turns out there are unfortunately political problems. However, we have, I think, succeeded. I've been calling up and talking to NTU graduates the last few days, finding out how they feel, and they're very, very positive. And in fact, one thing they all agree entirely on is that the quality of the instructional staff is just outstanding. And you see, that's one of the problems you have as a chair of a regular program. You have a faculty member who doesn't do very well for one reason or another. You can't just let them do nothing. But at NTU, I can. I go get another instructor from another school, and just say from now on, you know, we don't use him. And so it's very easy to quickly put together a program with all top-notch instructors. And also, the students that are out there are graduate engineers, so they, by and large, know whether the material they're getting is modern and up-to-date or not. So it's pretty easy to keep track of it. And I've just had a great time trying to produce better and better offerings in that program, and tying it back to our own videotape activity here.
I'm sorry, what does NTU stand for?
National Technological University.
Okay.
It's in Fort Collins, Colorado, and owns its own, leases its own transponder on a satellite.
Do you think that might foreshadow the way higher education might be in the future?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know whether it'll be satellite. Whether, you know, it might be fiber optic or something.
Oh, right, not the actual mode, but the concept of having that the best of each institution.
I think that concept has a potentially a lot going for it. The one problem with it is, I don't know how to do it for an undergraduate program in engineering where you have lots of laboratory activity. Okay, the master's program seldom has any laboratory activity, and many disciplines don't, so it wouldn't be a problem, but some disciplines would suffer. We've never learned how to do outreach laboratory, except we do here at Madison. We use the so-called intersession, the three-week session, and we run our advanced level three-credit labs in those three-week sessions, and the people from industry come in for 3 weeks. That's a that's a feasible thing, to be away for 3 weeks. It wears at least better than 15 weeks. Anyway, I'm still involved in that. I intend to stay involved in, as long as I feel that I can contribute to that program. In 1990, David Granger provided some funding to name Professor Lippo and myself both as named professors. Granger, I'm a Granger professor of power electronics.
Now who's David Granger?
David Granger is a graduate of he or his father is a graduate of Wisconsin, and the other one graduated from Illinois. And they own the Granger Corporation that sells industrial equipment, and he has given large sums of money to the college and the university.
The business school's named
The business school, and a large part of the new part of this building, of the engineering building, is he funded. And he provided money to have two named professorships in this area. And so since 1990, I have had a named professorship, which provides a sum of money to use for whatever I would like to use it for to further my activities. I've also been in an IEEE Distinguished Lecturer, which means I've delivered a number of lectures to IEEE, which is this professional society around the country. And sometime in 95, a gentleman by the name of Holdridge provided money to the department to have a departmental teaching award, and in 1995 I was voted that award. Finally, in 1996, published our book called Vector Control and Dynamics of AC Drives. We even got the word vector in the title of the book, published by Oxford University Press.
What is that? What's the significance of that? You got vector in the title.
This works. I was using this complex vector stuff along, and I wanted to pull it into the title of the book. It's probably the first book in English that does everything with using complex vectors.
Oh, okay.
I think, maybe not. First book in the U.S. No, it's not, because the original book by Lyon did it. Yeah. But so, and that was in 50. So 40 years later, we got another one.
How's that been received?
Very well so far.
It's used
as a text at several schools, but it's a graduate level book.
Oh, okay.
So there's probably only a dozen or more universities that have graduate courses in this area.
Do you ever get curious what other institutions use it? Have you ever tried to find out?
I've been told. People have told me they're using it at Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a few others. But I don't expect it. It's not a undergraduate level book which could sell thousands.
Yeah.
It's a graduate level book. In 1996, just to bring the dates up to things up to date, I decided to execute my ability to retire, and decided that I would no longer do things professionally that I didn't like to do. And I now only do things that turn me on, so to speak. So I'm still teaching. I plan to continue teaching for the foreseeable future. I have a very limited amount of committee work, which is largely ceremonial kinds of things, like fellowship committees and things like that. And I don't go to faculty meetings, and I don't I'm no longer trying to raise funds outside for research and WEMPEC, etc. So I've been enjoying myself immensely. I hope to continue along these lines. I'm toying with writing a second book for the other senior course that I teach, and I don't know yet whether I will or not. I am one of the thing I find that I most enjoy so far about being retired is that I have, you know, my schedule is quite empty. In fact, I'm very reluctant to make appointments. I was reluctant to make the appointment to make this tape, so I don't like to commit myself to any particular day or hour, because it's so nice to just decide in the morning what you want to do. That's really very nice. And I hope that I can continue to do that. Now, I have some, that's sort of a historical business, historical treatment. I have some general things.
Before you, yes. So retirement, in essence, is just sort of ceremonial too then. I mean, in essence, you could still be doing what you did as before retirement, have the status of emeritus, correct?
Yes, yes.
So what is different about being emeritus, defected? You can do whatever you want? I mean,
yes, that I can do whatever I want, that I no longer...
Well...
I no longer participate, for example, in voting for new faculty members. You know, voting whether we should bring somebody here. I have nothing to do with running the department.
What prevents a professor from just going emeritus way early in their career?
Well, you have to. It has to be voted by your colleagues, by your department.
Have to earn emeritus.
You have to earn it, yeah.
Oh, okay, so unless you didn't put in your time
as a
professor, you're not going to get it. Okay, I wasn't sure on that.
But you could be much younger if you chose. You know, you don't have to be in your 60s.
Yeah, I didn't know about that status. So.
I have some general materials, general kinds of things that I thought maybe would be worth getting in here.
Now Professor Novotny is going to talk about his teaching experiences during his career here at DW.
Okay, in the area of teaching, first of all, the courses that I've taught, I think despite my interest in electric machines and everything we've been talking about up to now, I think my favorite course to teach is what we call 230, the course on circuits. It's the first course that electrical engineers take. They're nominally sophomores, although most of them are juniors by the time they get there. And the reason that I enjoy it so much is there is an immense difference in the knowledge level of the students regarding electrical engineering between when they come in and when they go out of this course. When I teach 7-11, the upper highest level course I teach, these are graduate students who have been, you know, in electrical engineering programs for 4, 6, maybe 9, 10 years. What I can add to their knowledge over one semester is a tiny little bump. But these guys in the beginning, it's enormous. And I've always enjoyed that course, the basic course in circuits. I've taught it many, many times. And I did discover along the way, and I even introduced some innovations in the course at certain points, because one thing about it, it's a course of many, many, many small topics. And I thought, well, let's break it up into many small topics and have an exam for each one. And that means you have an exam every couple of class periods. But what I'll do is, if you don't get the exam right, I'll let you study again and I'll give you another one in my office. And you keep taking them until you get it right. And it worked pretty well. The first time I tried it, I had to make maybe 2, maybe 3 exams, the one I gave and 2 follow-ons, until I got to this one topic. And this one topic, man, I was up to exam 8 or something, and some of the people still couldn't get it right. And this particular topic is a place where you make a sort of a big abstraction. And I find that some students can't do that. It's just very difficult for them. And I jokingly said, but I'm not totally joking, that at that point, if they can't get that thing right, they should probably consider becoming a mechanical engineer. Because, and it turns out to be a good filter. It's what's called Thevenin's theorem, and Thevenin's theorem is a stumbling block for students.
Can you explain in layman terms?
Well, what Thevenin's theorem says, circuits means that you're studying circuits, collections of electrical components. And what Thevenin's theorem says is from any two points in that network, no matter how big it is, like the power grid made up of Madison, Gas, and Electric, for any two points, if you can look back in there and you can replace that entire network by two elements, one source and one impedance, as it's called. So you can replace a great, enormous network with a very simple equivalent circuit. But Thevenin's theorem also tells you how to figure out what they are, how to calculate them. And that's the thing that students couldn't do. And the thing that they couldn't do is, they said, look, every problem you make up for me is different. And I said, no, everyone is the same concept. You maybe do it, you do the arithmetic different, but the concept is exactly the same, and the principle is exactly the same, and you should be thinking about it exactly the same. And they can't.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's just that way, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an electrical engineer, but to me, I even understand what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they were in the wrong discipline.
I think they are.
Yeah.
I think they are.
They're too reductionistic in thinking, it sounds like. Yeah.
Well, they're too, they want to have a simple recipe for each one, so to speak. And actually, there is a simple recipe, but to them, it's not. See, the problem they have is there's not a simple recipe because I can make up problems in which the most common recipe doesn't work. But then you just go back to the definition, so to speak, and figure out what to do. And it's not hard at all. Okay. But they couldn't do it. Actually, that technique of having these short tests stayed in the department. I initiated it, and it stayed in the department for probably 10 or 12 years.
Yeah, well, it seems like a great way to troubleshoot where the problems are with learning.
It finally went away. I don't even know why it finally went away, but it did. We used to have a place where we had some students. We hired students to be in a room to help the other students. And we hired seniors to help sophomores, and it worked very well. I've also taught the course that follows that, which is a continuation, so to speak. Not nearly so much fun, because the ideas get very complicated and you don't progress as far. I've also taught 220 and 320, which are the electromagnetic fields courses. These students hate these because it's much harder to give practical examples. And the mathematics is, physics is much harder.
Don't you get a quantum mechanical realm then?
No, it's just that the problems are geometric. They have geometry. And it's difficult. I don't like it either, but it's very important stuff. And I've spent a good part of my life trying to find good examples for those courses that make them meaningful. In fact, that's something that I am very strong on. I have a whole cupboard full over there of real-life things, examples of various kinds of electrical components and transformers and small motors and everything else, which I bring to class all the time to let people see what it is we're talking about. And I'm constantly on the look for unusual ones that will provoke people's students' interest. Such and such, like I just showed this. Just showing Paul an example. Okay, just a bunch of magnets. So I make my point here to Paul. I've also taught control courses, two control courses, the first and second level ones. I haven't done that for a long time. And as a matter of fact, I never really got turned on by those as much as my main area. The main course that I have taught probably the most in my career is the junior level machines course, 355. I find it a very fascinating course to teach. It used to be a required course, now it's elective. I prefer it as an elective course. The students are much more responsive. when they've chosen the course themselves. That's a course where I have many, many demonstrations, and I'm always trying to create new demonstrations to illustrate the points. Then finally, the senior course, 411, Introduction to Electric Drives, just exactly what it says, talks about how industrial drives are built and how the motors work, etc. And then finally, the graduate course, 711, Dynamics of Electric Drives, is the one that Professor Lippo and I have created. In a sense, the last three courses are ones that we have created in WMPEC. I think there were similar courses before, but they're so totally different now that you would not recognize them at all. We generally get good enrollments in all these courses. They're all elective. The machines course runs every semester. We get enrollments of 15 to 20. The drives course usually has 20 to 25 on campus and an equal number off campus now. Often have 25 off-campus students watching on videotape. The 711 course gets maybe a dozen on-campus and a dozen off-campus people. That's what it was last semester. So good enrollments. Through the years, I would say I haven't seen a lot of change in the quality of our students, except for the following two things. Somewhere around 75 to 85, when the enrollments got so big in engineering, we had to do some limiting, so departments were allowed to put a minimum grade point on for entry after the freshman year. And EE got up to, I think, 3.4 for entry after the freshman year. And there were some years there, some groups of students that came through here where they were really outstanding. It's always bothered me that in my senior class, there will always be somebody in the class who you keep wondering, how did they get here? How did they get to be a senior? And if you look, you find that they've got many more credits, they've attempted many more credits than they have. And so on. Well, those people just weren't there. So there was about a 4 or 5 year period when the student body was significantly higher quality academically. We're back pretty much, I would say, now normal, as far as I can tell.
So you don't have that 3.4?
No. No, it's back down to 2.5 or something.
Huh.
And the other place I've seen an improved quality is in a higher quality is in the graduate students that we have in WMPEC. WMPEC, one of the very strong advantages of WMPEC is that it's very attractive to students. Obviously, come into a program where there are 60 companies involved in the program, you know, the chances are pretty good that you might get a job when you graduate. That's been the case. So we have attracted some pretty good students, and in particular, I'm thinking of people who have been working for several years as engineers and then have come back to school here at Madison to do a PhD. Some of those people have really been outstanding, outstanding people.
You get a PhD and go back into industry?
Yep, many of them go back into industry. So we've had some very high quality students that have been attracted via WMPEC. We've had no problem competing with any school in the nation for grad students. That is, our program is competitive with anybody's. We've had many students that have come here instead of MIT. MIT has a program in this area of power electronics, but it isn't near as big as ours.
Really? Caltech and...
Yeah, and there are some programs. Minnesota has a program. So we've done very well, and there I've seen an improvement. In terms of probably the biggest change that I've seen is the fact that we now have women in our classes. We just, you know, when I started here, or when I was a student, there were simply no women at all. If you had one woman in an engineering course, it was unusual. Now it's unusual not to have a number of them in your class.
Well, what's the ratio, would you say?
Well, the ratio is still very high. It's still, I doubt if the women are 10-15%. And also, I think we, certainly at the undergraduate level, we have more non-citizen students than we used to. At one time, the undergraduate enrollment here was heavily, heavily Wisconsin students. And the Wisconsin students were heavily, heavily first-time engineer. There were, you know, there were no engineers in their family at all. They were mostly rural, and so on. So that's changed. That's changed quite a bit through the years. The mix of students, and I don't know. I guess it's, you know, I haven't noticed any change in the quality.
Well, do you think it made a difference that they weren't from an engineering background, that their parents were?
No.
Okay.
No.
I just wondered why you brought it.
I brought it up simply because you wonder why do people pick this field you're in, right?
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because, well, my father was and my grandfather was and so on, and they simply weren't. As I think back over, you know, over some of the students, and these are, I'm thinking now of graduate students. The first one that comes to mind is Dick Thomas, because Dick, I would say of all the students, he's a PhD, of all the students I've dealt with, he's the number one engineer. Dick has always impressed me as being a first-rate engineer and having extraordinary clarity in his thinking about engineering problems. And of course, he went into business with another one of our graduates, and they formed a very large company that is still in existence, and is pretty much what I'd expect that Dick would have done.
What company is that?
A company called Markwip.
They
actually have here in town.
And what are they?
Well, Markwip builds corrugated box manufacturing machines.
Okay.
And Dick is. Well, I had Dick, and I used to teach, that's a course I forgot. I used to teach a course called Engineering Analysis. It was a course to simply get together with some reasonably good students and look at what engineering analysis is all about. How do you analyze a problem? And what I would do is throw out problems, and they'd try to work on it, and then we'd talk about how we went around the solution. And Dick always, he always amazed me how he, I mean, I wanted to have him come up there and give the lecture.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, even when he was, while he was a student here, he had already been an engineer. He had already worked as an engineer for Boeing for a couple, several years. So he had some experience. But he just really impressed me. Another fellow that I'll always remember is Ed Cornell. And Ed is now, he's been a vice president of a couple of companies. Ed was just a lot of fun and a very successful manager. And at the time he was a student, I didn't see him as a manager at all. But he, after a few years at General Electric, he suddenly appeared as some kind of high-up manager. And I asked him what happened, and he said, well, GE sent him to charm school. but he's done very, very well. And then Tom Nondahl. Tom's a local Wisconsin fellow, got a PhD, and he's just, I don't know, I'd hate to say which one of my PhDs was just the most able, but it might be Tom. He's at currently a research position at Allen Bradley Rockwell.
So it sounds like your top students should have chosen private industry.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Yep. In fact, all of the ones I thought of here have. I had a student by the name of Jim Davis. Jim was central Wisconsin, and he hadn't done very well as an undergrad. He came to see me, and he really liked the course he was in that I was teaching, and he really wanted to go for a master's degree, but he had a miserable grade point, and. He said, but if you look, he said, it's my freshman and my early part of my career. So I looked, and he'd been doing well in class. So I said, I looked at his record, and it was true. So I said, okay, I'll write a letter, see if we can get you into grad school. And he did. He got into grad school, went all the way through to a PhD, did beautifully. And actually, he went, he did his minor in astrophysics because his hobby was astronomy. And his first job he took was automating the telescope at the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., the one that takes navigational data. And then he went to New Mexico as a professor. And unfortunately, he...
You're talking about University of Mexico?
University of New Mexico.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, one of the Los Alamos.
And he unfortunately became ill there, and he died very young. Died at like 35, something like that. In fact, one of the most difficult things I ever did was to speak at his funeral in up in Mesita, Wisconsin, because it was such a waste. He was such a bright guy. A master student, Wally Kerr. Wally, the thing that impressed me about Wally was he could do a homework problem on a one page that the rest of the class would each take 30 pages or 20 pages. And his solution was right and elegant. And I could always marvel at how concise he could be. He never went on for a PhD.
Do you know what he's doing now?
He could, yeah.
No, do you know what he's doing now?
Yeah, he's at one of the Milwaukee companies. Oh. I'm not sure which one. And then I'll mention Xingyi Xu and Qingqi Chen, two young men from the People's Republic of China that did PhDs with me and were, for ability coupled with drive, I've never seen their equal. They're both together working at the Ford Motor Company Research Laboratories, working, Qingqi's working for Xingyi.
One of them's working for the other.
Yeah, right now. So, and they were really outstanding. And there were many, many others. Those are just some that came to mind. For some reason, my graduate students, I think we're going to run out of tape, huh? I always had a close relationship with the grad students, PhDs and masters. We got to know each other quite well and worked together very well. And these guys, in the early days, this is back in the 70s, Dick Thomas and Ed Cornell, that group of people, one day, the faculty here used to, when I first came, the EE faculty used to meet every week as a faculty for lunch. And they would talk if they had any business. So every Wednesday, we would drive out to the Cuba Club in Shorewood, and we'd be gone about an hour and a quarter. And when I came back, I had an appointment with Dick Thomas. And Dick, for some reason, was very nervous. And he was nervous this day. And then I noticed that his fingernails were all dirty, which that was uncommon also. And I didn't think much of it. And when I went out that night, walked over to my car, and I had a very old car. My wife had a good car, and I had this junker. And it was a bad car, and I hadn't cleaned it in years. I washed it occasionally, but... And what somebody had done was one half of the car was shiny bright, and the other half looked just like it looked in the morning. And God, I didn't know what happened. I opened the door, and there in the back seat was all the wax and rags and everything else. Turns out my grad students had decided that my car that it was inappropriate for a professor to drive around such an ugly car.
Oh.
So they waxed it. And the reason Dick was nervous is they had just finished waxing it when he came in here. And the reason his fingernails were dirty was that was not dirt, that was blue paint under his nails. And they left me the stuff to do the rest of the car. But actually, I sold it and just started over. But there were numerous times when we had a little, we had fun. We had fun, I guess. Let me just make a couple comments about teaching other than regular classroom teaching. One of the things we have here is a very strong extension program, now it's engineering professional development, short courses for industry. I think through the years, I made a rough count of something like 50 short courses. These are courses that last a week. And people come to campus. The major ones are on machines and drives and on magnetics. And there's like 50 or 60 people there. No homework, nothing, just all presentation. A lot of notes. Not all of these were on campus, though. Maybe 30% of them were in-house, where a company wanted us to come there and do it, for spend 3 days at the company and do the course. I just want to remark that these have been very important as industrial contacts. I don't know how many WEMPEC sponsorships actually came out of contacts at those courses. Significant numbers. They're really very important. From a financial point of view, they're hardly worth it. You do get paid an overpayment, but the university restricts the amount you can earn. Used to, maybe they've changed that, so that you're not getting paid very much. So you have to do it as a professional development kind of thing. But it is definitely worth it, and I just wanted to make that point. And I've always enjoyed them, because you meet so many people in industry, and they usually ask questions that are things you wouldn't have thought about otherwise, because they're different than what the on-campus guys would say. The second thing I just comment is the videotape credit courses. I have three of them, the machines, the drives, and the dynamics of drives. They are very useful for off-campus MS work and very popular by engineers. They've also been very popular in companies. Companies just buy the sets of tape. They buy the whole course and use it in-house as a training program for new engineers. And we even offer an upgrade. When we retape it, we'll give them an upgrade for a much smaller amount of money and give them the new tapes for the old tapes. And we've sold, I don't know how many sets, many, many sets of tapes that are all over the world, actually. Also, on campus, the videotapes are very useful for students who have to be away for a day, particularly seniors. They're off interviewing. They miss a day of class. They can come and take up the tape, or for people whose schedule doesn't let them take a course in the semester they're graduating, they can take one on tape. And we do that regularly. It's usually two or three people that have just a screwed up schedule and can't get the course and want it. So it's very valuable from that point of view also. So they have lots of uses. I'm sold on them. In fact, the only negative I can think of is it's a little more work when you make them, obviously, but I think that's mitigated by the fact that because you're on TV, you prepare more, you prepare better, you do a better job. So I think your teaching is better, whether you like it or not. You sort of can't help it because you're shamed into it, so to speak. So that's the only negative that I can think of about the videotape program. I'm sold, and I would certainly encourage anybody interested in that to participate. The third point about outreach teaching is that, and I've tried to sell this, and I cannot sell some of my colleagues. Some of them I have. Within WEMPEC, everybody's videotaping. But I've tried to sell it outside of WEMPEC, and I can't do it. And I've made up all kinds of arguments. And my most potent one is that the feedback you get from the students in the outreach program, because they are graduate engineers, will be different, in some ways better, and will lead you to a better course. They say yes, but it's not worth it. I mean, it's too much work. So I haven't been able to do it. I think I'll continue to try, because I think it's a very important function of ourselves as engineering educators. Particularly, I think it's important for those engineering educators who have never been engineers. who have never been involved in industry, you know, at least you talk to these guys and listen to what they're saying and whatever. I think it can be very useful.
Sort of establish a balance between private industry knowledge and academic knowledge.
Yeah. Why don't we stop?